We're going to be talking about leading and managing in the workplace from a Christian perspective. You know, it turns out actually I did invite a couple of folks that work for me to this conference. I don't see them here, and I'm a little concerned they're at the session. I'm actually a little concerned there at the session on how to deal with difficult bosses, but I'm just curious, how many of you are currently in a position where you're managing someone or you're in a leadership position in your company? Oh, that's great. Wow. How many of you aspire for a leadership position? That's great. Excellent. Well, I just want to tell you a little bit about myself before I get started. So I work in the high-tech arena, in the local high-tech arena, for a number of companies. Been a senior executive with a number of companies over the last 15 years. I'm currently with a company called Eloqua as the senior VP of product development. And prior to that, I was the CEO of a security technology company, which is a little bit of a turnaround, and you'll hear a little bit of that story as well as I later in the talk. But and we were able to, by God's grace, turn it around and sell the company to a bigger company. What I'm sharing today really comes from a desire I have that I'm sure really all of you share, which is I have a desire to be just faithful as a Christian in the workplace. I have a desire to be faithful as a disciple of Jesus Christ in the context of the workplace. But I also have a desire to be faithful, fruitful in my work. I have a desire to be fruitful as a manager and as a leader in my company, right? So this dual pursuit of both faithfulness and fruitfulness is something that, this quest that I've been on for the last, you know, dozen years or so. So I'm not an author, I'm not a pastor, I'm not an expert on this topic. I'm just like you, I'm learning along the way. And so what I'm going to share with you is really stuff that I've learned along the way. So I need God's help for this session, so if you can just join me in prayer, I'd really appreciate it. Father, regardless of any position we may hold professionally, before your majesty, we are lowly and we are small. But God, you have regarded our low estate. You have saved us. You have adopted us into your family. You have been so kind to us, oh God. So I pray for this morning. I pray that I might speak clearly. I pray that I might speak from a motivation of to serve my brothers and sisters. And I pray that you would bless this time, that it might be edifying to us. In Jesus' name, amen. Great. All right. There you go. 80,072. Just anyone want to guess what that number is? Way back there, Tony. The hour spent. No, not really. But good. That was a good one. Anyone else? That was a good attempt. Good. Well, it turns out that it's the number of books, the number of paperback titles under the category of business management and leadership on Amazon.com. So a lot of books have been written on this topic, right? And even when you narrow it down to just business leadership, you take away general management topics like project management or financial forecasting or negotiation skills, you're still left with over 8,000 titles just on business leadership alone. So when it comes to business leadership, there's been a lot of advice dispensed on the topic, a lot of research, a lot of books written. And by the way, there are really some outstanding books. Here are a few. Good to Great. How many of you have read that? Yeah, fantastic book, right? I love Jim Collins. He's great. When I first started in management, there's The 1 Minute Manager. You know, it's an old standby. I think maybe the first book I read when I my God in management. I thought, 1 minute manager, I think I can do that. A couple of years ago, I read this book, Four Obsessions of an Extraordinary Executive. I was having a lot of challenges with my team, and this book really helped me. Now, maybe you're one of the guys that really, you know, you like to be inspired. You like biographies. Here's one that's been very popular, Steve Jobs. You know, fantastic biography. You get a real insight into the man as a leader. But it sort of begs the question, what could I possibly share with you today that hasn't already been said? You know, over 8,000 books on business leadership, and probably said better. More importantly, maybe, what does the Bible have to add to this topic on business leadership or leadership in the workplace? Well, I believe there's one thing that hasn't been discussed in any of these fine books. It's actually the question that we're here to sort of unpack, which is this. What is distinctive about a Christian leader or manager in the workplace? What is distinctive about a Christian leader or manager in the workplace? What special attributes mark a Christian leader in the workplace? Now, there are a lot of ways to answer that. So, you know, I'm not suggesting that you know, what I'm going to share is sort of comprehensive, but I'm going to share with you some perspectives that I have. If you're a Christian, this is actually a very important question, and perhaps the only other question that might be just as important, if not more important, is this. Why do you care? Right? Why is a biblically informed leadership model important or even relevant to our workplace? Well, I'd like to suggest that the reason it's important is this. God engages and shapes this world through leaders, and he's done it throughout history. You know, read Nehemiah and read about how God positions and uses a leader to manage the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. Read Hebrews 11, as we, you know, in Sovereign Grace Church of Fairfax, where I'm from, over the last few weeks, we've just camped out on Sundays on Hebrews 11. And if you read Hebrews 11, you'll read about how God used faith-filled men and women, with really men and women with ordinary profiles, but leaders that God raised up to shape the course of history. You know, you have Noah, who saves the world through a massive boat-building project. And you have Moses, raised up by God to deliver a nation from slavery. You read other parts of the Old Testament, you might read about Esther, who saves her people through a courageous leadership, all the while maneuvering around a politically motivated nemesis, right? So God uses leaders. And he used William Wilberforce in the late 1700s to lead the abolition of slave trade in England. God uses leaders. Now, maybe your ambitions are a little more modest, not going to be saving the world or leading a nation from slavery. But I'd ask you, imagine what God will do through the fruitful leadership of gospel-inspired men and women in various realms of work and culture. Just imagine, how would things be different? How would the landscape of business or government or academia be different? How would the gospel mission be advanced in various realms of culture? How would the gospel mission be advanced throughout the world? How would the little part of the world, of this world, the part that you influence, change and be different as a result of your leadership? That's what we're here to discuss. That's what we're here to talk about. I want to share with you four perspectives, as I said, you know, not comprehensive, just kind of things I've learned along the way. Four perspectives that can help shape our paths as Christian leaders and managers in the workplace. And I'd like to start by looking at Colossians 3, verse 22 to chapter 4, verse 1. It's only been brought up like five times since the conference started, so I'm sure you're familiar with it now. So if you have your Bibles, turn to Colossians 3, verse 22. If not, I'll just read it, read along here. Before I get to it, I'll just say that, you know, Paul addresses this relationship between masters and slaves, and it really offers an interesting picture on how the gospel influences working relationships. So I'll go ahead and read it. It says, "Slaves, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. For the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he has done, and there is no partiality. Masters, treat your slaves justly and fairly, knowing that you also have a master in heaven." Now, to appreciate this verse, this passage, really need to understand a little bit of what preceded this in Colossians. So I'm going to give you a quick flyby, okay? Chapter 1, Paul starts with the gospel. He reminds the Colossians of the gospel. He reminds them of how they've been delivered out of the domain of darkness into God's kingdom. He then marvels at the preeminence of Christ, who he says is the image of the invisible God, and the work of Christ, how through the cross he reconciles all things to himself. Then from that point, he moves on. He talks about the implications of the gospel. Talks about the need to put off the deeds of darkness and put on the deeds of light. Eventually, he lands in this back half of chapter 3, where Paul talks about how the gospel affects roles in God's kingdom. Roles like husbands and wives. Roles like parent and children. Roles like master and slave. So, if you think of this underlying theme of this section on roles, it might be this. When it comes to roles in God's kingdom, the gospel changes everything. Gospel changes everything with regard to how we conduct ourselves in specific roles. Whether as husbands, fathers, children, business leader, entrepreneur, project manager, the gospel has something to say about how you conduct yourself in that role. Now, in the passage we just read, Paul addresses the relationship between slaves and masters in view of the gospel. Just as an aside, Paul isn't condoning slavery here. All he's doing is he is addressing how the gospel radically affects the existing social relationships of the day. But he starts by speaking to bondservants, and he tells them that they need to work differently in light of the gospel. Need to work obediently, heartily. Not so much to please their earthly masters, but for the Lord. In essence, he's saying to them, remember who your true master is. It's Jesus Christ. And it's Christ that will reward you. If you don't get your just due here, be sure Christ will reward you. And if anyone mistreats you, you can count on God to repay. But then he turns to the masters and he says this, treat your bond servants justly and fairly, knowing that you also have a master in heaven. In short, even though they are in authority, Paul is saying to the Christian master, you need to exercise your authority with Christ in view. Paul is reminding them that they too are under the authority and directive of a master. The same heavenly master that rules over the slaves rules over them. As a result, they're not free to just treat these slaves as they're inclined or as they please. They have an obligation to treat them consistent with the values and desires of their heavenly master. Now, we don't operate in a master-slave, a master-servant relationship with those who function under our leadership at work. But this passage has a bearing on us as Christian leaders, because the gospel changes everything. It changes how we lead, how we manage. And the first implication of the gospel is this. Gospel-inspired leaders lead with Christ in view. Gospel-inspired leaders lead with Christ in view. As gospel-inspired leaders, the way we operate is governed by Jesus Christ. He's our Savior. He's our Master. He's our King. Right? We lead from a heart that's been changed by the good news of who Christ is and what He's done for us. There's no way that the gospel has no effect on your leadership. It is impossible for the gospel not to leave an imprint on your leadership. You know, we draw inspiration primarily from Jesus, not Steve Jobs or Mitt Romney or Barack Obama. Now that, I just want to say, that doesn't mean that we don't learn a great deal from a number of great leaders in business or government. We should and we do. You know, we should make every effort to sharpen our skills and grow as leaders. You know, read books, attend seminars, seek out mentors. You know, I try to do that. I read a couple of business books every year. I try to observe great leaders and learn from them. But gospel-inspired leaders do their learning through the lens of the gospel. They allow the gospel to be the primary influence in their leadership model, in their leadership practice. Now, let me share with you one of the ways the gospel has personally impacted my leadership approach. The gospel has given me new eyes to see my coworkers, including those who work for me, to see them as men and women made in the image of God. You know, it's so easy when you're in authority. Doesn't matter how many folks are under your authority, but it's so easy when you're in authority over another person to view that person primarily as just an instrument to do your bidding. It's not a conscious thing, but it's so easy to fall into that trap, an instrument to execute a corporate plan or to deliver on a project. But there's so much more than that, right? Genesis 1 tells us that men and women are uniquely made in the image of God. We're unique in creation. There's a special part of our composition that's meant to reflect who God is. And while the fall has marred that image, it hasn't erased it. So it leads to my second point and the second perspective, which is gospel-inspired leaders see those they lead as image bearers. Now, by the way, this applies to every single person you interact with at work. You know, every person carries a semblance of God's image, albeit marred by the fall. But every person carries some remaining semblance of God's image. Not just Christians, every single person you work with. I want to share with you a quote from R.C. Sproul here that I thought it was helpful and emphasizes this point. It says, R.C. Sproul, the theologian, says this: we go back to creation and we see that man is made in the image and in the likeness of God. Not in the sense that God has a body, but in terms of our nature. You are called to be living images that reflect and communicate the character of God Himself. You know, friends, you work daily with men and women who were created to bear God's image. They have unique gifts, they have unique personalities, and they have an eternal destiny. Right? Part of our privilege as leaders and managers is to recognize the unique makeup of every individual and help bring these gifts to fruition. We also get to play a role in influencing them for eternity. What a privilege we have. What a responsibility. Friends, you need to get excited. If you're in management, if you're in leadership in the workplace, you need to get excited about this privilege that God has given to you. And the great thing is, I believe it makes for more effective leadership to see the ones you lead as made in the image of God. Now, I want to share with you, I didn't always view things this way. Years ago, I didn't relate to my coworkers, my team members, as image bearers. I would never outwardly express it, but I saw them, if I was to be honest, I'd probably say I saw them more as instruments to carry out my design, things I wanted done. This attitude, not a good attitude, had a distinct effect on my management approach. You know, there was no joy in getting to know the people under my charge. You know, no delighting in their personalities or gifts. No interest in their strengths and weaknesses other than as a means to manage their performance. No initiative on my part to find out what made them tick, what motivated them. On the darker side, when they failed to sort of fulfill my expectations for performance, at times I was harsh with some of them. I would make comments that were disrespectful or sometimes, sad to say, maybe demeaning. As God opened my eyes, I started to understand that God intended something more for me as a leader and manager. A fuller picture of what it means to lead men and women, to lead them as image bearers. It means recognizing the intrinsic value of each person, a value that God has placed in them that is independent of their performance. This value that God has placed in them is independent of their performance. You have no idea how radical this is. You see, the management ethic of this world, if I'm not overstating it, I would say, you know, it's solely or at least primarily about production. Even when business leaders talk about leading in a more authentic or personal way, which is popular these days, it's typically justified on a pragmatic basis as a means to deliver a better result. Let me give you an example. Just yesterday I read a Harvard Business Review article on the cost of incivility, meaning how much does it cost the business when managers and leaders are rude and may demean or disrespect their employees. And so they wrote a great article. You know, there's a cost to the business. There's attrition, there's low morale, there's a lack of creativity, and they tried to frame that. But as a Christian, we have a higher reason for not demeaning employees when they don't fulfill our expectations. It's because they're made in the image of God, right? So, you know, very often when business leaders talk about, you know, leading in a more authentic way, it's usually on a pragmatic basis, you know, so that they can deliver a better result. Now, don't get me wrong, results matter. But gospel-inspired leaders see the worth and dignity of every person under their leadership, not measured primarily in terms of their production or performance, but in terms of the intrinsic worth that God has placed in them. It's the fundamental difference, if you think about it, it's the fundamental difference between managing people like they're cogs in a corporate machinery or managing them as men and women made in God's image. See, a machine is valued for its efficiency, its productivity, its performance, return on investment. But human beings are different, right? Human beings are valued for their intrinsic value that God has placed in them. Now, an aside, performance and productivity are important things to manage, right, as a manager in the workplace. It's what we get paid to do. So, you know, I know some of you might have alarm bells going off, and you know, I just wanted to say that. Shortly, I will share with you why I believe this view of seeing men and women as made in the image of God is not in conflict with managing for performance. And I'll actually talk about a tool that I use that I think resonates with what we're talking about here. But viewing our coworkers and subordinates as image bearers compels us to love and serve them. You know, in Mark 10, Jesus speaks to his disciples about what true greatness looks like. And he says, you know, there are leaders who will lord it over their followers, leaders of this world. To his disciples, he said, you need to be different. Whoever would be first, or whoever would be great, need to be the servant of all. And then he says this, for even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. You know, I was meditating on that and I was just thinking, Jesus' essential mission was to serve. How would my workplace be different if I walked in on Monday morning with that attitude? How would that be different? Bottom line is, greatness is about serving. And we serve because Christ served us in the ultimate way by giving his life as a ransom for us. So gospel-inspired leaders are servant leaders. You know, friends, you've heard many messages on, you know, this part about greatness and servant leadership. So I'm not likely to improve on what you've heard. But I want to draw one implication that I think is important and pertinent to us as business leaders or leaders in the workplace. And it's this: your leadership is not about you. Your leadership is not about you. It's not about validating your unique gifts. It's not about how you're going to be a hero and, you know, save your company. You know, as leaders, we're so tempted to think it's about us. It's about our unique gifts that we're just waiting for everyone around us to recognize and to validate. We can be so focused on our plans, advancing our agendas. And so often, I've seen it in my own life, has a tendency to take center stage in my life. I think what this passage helps us to understand, or really what Jesus talks about in Mark 10, what it helps us to understand is that gospel-inspired leaders have an outward orientation. It's about serving others through our leadership. And when we start to take our eyes off ourselves, it's remarkable what God can do through us. You know, we get to see how our leadership can actually be an instrument to help someone succeed, to help someone else grow in their skills, to help a junior member of a team overcome a hurdle so that they can take the next step in their careers. Now, one of the challenges we have as Christians is this. What Jesus says about servant leadership is really countercultural. I mean, who really leads like this and survives to tell about it in the business world, right? Challenge we have with Jesus' definition of greatness is this. We live in an upside down world. You know, this orientation to be a servant isn't what the world values in leaders. The world values self-assured, confident masters of the universe, right? Not servant leaders who give their lives away. So the world is clearly uncomfortable and doesn't welcome that model in a lot of situations. But if we're honest, perhaps we too are personally uncomfortable with Jesus' brand of greatness and leadership. You might have concerns. You know, if I lead like this, won't I be viewed as passive or weak or aimless? Or maybe you're saying, how can I even function as a manager? How do I exercise discipline? How do I give someone a tough performance review that really needs one? Or in the unfortunate situation, how do I actually fire someone? This doesn't feel consistent with this idea of loving and serving, right? So I want to just say a few words about what servant leadership isn't. Gospel-inspired servant leadership isn't passive. You know, if you're the kind of leader who is thinking about how to serve those who work for you, to get them better at their jobs, to inspire them to do their best work, to equip them for their present role, and work that they have to do, you're not going to be passive. You know, if you're interested in advancing the objectives of your team, your business unit, your company, you're going to be anything but passive. And gospel-inspired leaders aren't weak either. You know, let's face it, no one is served by weak, indecisive leadership. So leading with a service mentality means actually being strong and decisive for the good of others, not weak and double-minded. Now, I want to address how to manage for performance, because I think there's that tension there. You might be feeling it right now. You know, they're made in the image of God. We're supposed to love and serve these folks that work for us. But I got to do my job. I have to be able to exercise discipline. I have to be able to evaluate performance, right, if you're managing someone. So how do you do that? So, you know, I want to address how you manage for performance and exercise discipline, both of which are necessary as a leader and manager. And I just want to share with you a tool, a framework. This might be seemingly really practical, but I hope it helps you. I want to share with you a simple tool that I think resonates with the values of a gospel-centered or gospel-inspired leader. And it's actually something we use at a company. You know, speaking of things that you learn along the way, when we start using it at Eloqua, I said, this really makes sense. This is consistent with what I've been trying to do as a manager. So we call it the get it done and do it right quadrant. And it's really simple, right? This simple tool is used to manage every employee on two dimensions. On getting stuff done. Fruitfulness. So, and then the other dimension is, are they doing it right? Are they faithful to the values that you believe in, that the company believes in, right? So, let me walk through this a little bit. On the x-axis here, you get the get it done quadrant. And this is about, is the individual delivering results? Are they executing projects on time and within budget? Are they achieving sales targets if they're a salesperson? You know, if they're a customer service rep, are they answering the phones and getting good customer satisfaction score? It's about results, because results really matter. Fruitfulness matters. Matters to God. Now, on the y-axis here, the do-it-right axis, it's about faithfulness to the values that you believe in, right? Are they doing things in the right way, with high integrity, for instance, or being a collaborative team player? Are they open to taking feedback? Because doing things in the right way matters as well. It's not enough. Your gospel-inspired leader, it's not enough just to get to the end result. How you get there matters as well. And I know that resonates with each of you. So I'm going to unpack these quadrants a little bit and just talk a little bit about, you know, these quadrants. And so, first of all, on the top right-hand quadrant, these are folks that are just knocking it out of the park. They are getting the results, and they're doing it in the right way. You wish for all your employees to be in that quadrant. I think from your own experience, you know that's not the case. And but these are folks that are just doing fantastic and really doing it right and getting the results as well. Now, on the lower right-hand quadrant are folks that are getting the results. They're getting the business results. They're delivering projects on time or they're achieving their sales targets, but they might be leaving a trail of dead bodies along the way, or they might be upsetting the entire project team or driving everyone to the ground, or they might not be doing their work with high integrity. So with folks in this quadrant, one of the goals you have is simply, obviously, to move them up to the top right-hand quadrant, and a lot of times it involves coaching. Coaching them specifically on character issues and helping them see that they can get to the same results but do it in the right way. Now, in the top left-hand quadrant, you have the folks that they aren't getting the results, you know, but they've got a great attitude. They are collaborative. They take feedback. And there are a lot of reasons why folks don't get the right results. Now, sometimes it just takes some people a little longer, if they're new to a role, to sort of learn the role. Sometimes they're just hitting a bad patch. If they're in sales, things don't, you know, can sometimes happen that way. But the point is, with this quadrant, you want to help equip them with some skills. You want to maybe, you know, match them with someone who can teach them and show them the ropes, and you want to deploy best practices for them so that they can adopt those best practices. The goal here in this quadrant, when you're managing folks in either of these two quadrants, is clearly to move them to the top right-hand quadrant, right? So that's, you know, all, I would say, just about everyone in your organization should fall within one of these top three quadrants. But then you have the bottom left-hand quadrant. That's not a pleasant quadrant, right? So these are folks that are really struggling. They're not getting the results, and they might not have the right attitude. And here's what I would say from my experience. People shouldn't stay in that quadrant too long. You know, your goal is to move them to one of these quadrants as quickly as possible. You really can't leave them there for too long. And it doesn't serve them. I believe that from just years of managing and just thinking about this, people know when they're failing. And it's not loving, and it doesn't serve them for them to remain in that quadrant. And sometimes, and our goal, even for the folks there, is to find them a home in one of these other quadrants, and sometimes that's not in your group. It's not in your company. And part of what you're doing is you are exercising discipline at times, ultimately, to let them go so that they can find a place where they can be all the way at the top right-hand quadrant. So that's just this tool I've found to be helpful. And the thing that I've done along the way is also match it with a sort of a bright spots and dark spots discussion. And the reason I do that is it sort of allows me to get into deeper conversations about things they're doing well and things they need to work on, right? So the quadrant is sort of like a big picture, and then the bright spots, dark spots sort of helps hone in specific areas. But this tool really allows you to have a conversation about how they're doing relative to both dimensions. And having honest, meaningful performance evaluations, even when it's not the most positive feedback, is one of the ways we express care through our leadership. Having meaningful, honest performance evaluations is one of the ways we express care and love through our leadership. And we need to be doing this regularly. You know, if the employee only hears about this once a year, we're not loving them. We're not caring for them. Does this make sense? Helpful? Okay. Now, let me switch gears a little bit. A few years ago, I was in the midst of one of the toughest assignments in my professional career. I was leading a company in the midst of a turnaround. You know, the company had lost its way in some respects. It wasn't as competitive as it used to be. There were issues with sales, engaging with new accounts, and marketing had problems. Our positioning in the market was problematic, and they had some problems in the product as well. And as the CEO, I was charged with turning that around. Now, running any company is challenging. It's challenging work. But turning around a troubled company is doubly difficult. Some of you have had that experience. You know, you have to halt the negative spiral, the negative momentum, before you can actually build on that a solid base and start achieving some success. On top of that, I was a first-time CEO, so I had no prior experience to lean on. If I was honest, it was a job in many ways that kind of felt a little bigger than I could handle, you know. But it had a wonderful effect on my soul. Because many times during that sort of period, I turned to God in prayer for wisdom and strength. Made a habit of spending Wednesday lunchtimes walking around in the park, just praying, meditating on God's word. I want you to know, you know, I tell you that not because it's really important that you know, I didn't do that because I was particularly disciplined in my spiritual disciplines. In fact, I lack discipline in a lot of areas in my life. But in the midst of this particular situation, I found myself regularly engaging in prayer. It wasn't because I was disciplined. It's because I was desperate. I needed God's help, and I knew it. I was also aware of God's sovereign hand over the affairs of the company. In fact, what was interesting was over a period of time when I would discuss the sort of prospects of the company, of different initiatives that we would do, found myself including in my vernacular the phrase, if the Lord wills. You know, it wasn't planned. You know, wasn't a religious phrase I threw in for good measure. It happened because I was aware of God's sovereign hand over our affairs as a company and over my leadership. Now, make no mistake, we worked really hard. And I'd like to think we worked smart as well. But I also knew that we needed God's blessing, and He did bless us. And we were able to turn the company around and sell it to a larger company for good return to our investors. Now, how I wish that this sense of dependence that I had during that period was more of my everyday posture at every job that I've had. Sadly, this typically isn't the case, but it's what I strive to be. And it's what I believe in, right? And I believe that gospel-inspired leaders lead with an active dependence on God. They are aware of their need for God, and they turn to Him regularly. When faced with trouble, their first and primary instinct is to turn to God. Now, there are many verses that we could look to deepen this discussion, but I'd just like to look at one. It's Psalm 50, verse 15. It says this, "Call on me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me." Now, how many of you, in your best day as a Christian, you want to glorify God in the work that you do? Right? You want to do as 1 Corinthians 10:31 says and exhorts, in whatever you do, whether you eat or you drink or you work, do it all to the glory of God. I do. That's what I want. Well, at least according to Psalm 50, verse 15, there's one way we glorify God as leaders in the workplace. And in this particular passage, it's not by being a more ethical leader, even though ethics are important and we should have high ethics. It's not by getting better results than everyone else. Although, as I talked about earlier, results matter. They really do matter. It's very simple, but so profound. Call on Him in the day of trouble. You have a job that gives you trouble? Projects have gone awry? Looming business crisis? Call on Him in the day of trouble. You have a boss who's difficult to get along with? Co-workers who you think seek to undermine you? Call on Him in the day of trouble. If you're afraid, maybe, that you're not succeeding in your role as a manager or leader at work, concerned about your future, call on Him in the day of trouble. See, we think that glorifying and magnifying Christ is about doing better than everyone else. Sort of the business equivalent of scoring the touchdown and then doing the end zone dance. You know, it's not so. It's about calling on Christ in the day of your trouble. It's not in our achievements. I believe it's not in our achievements that we most glorify God, but really in our limitations. You know, friends, let me let you in on a secret, which at least I know to be true about me, but we're all limited. Some of us more than others. And it's not a result of the fall. It's the way we were designed. We were meant to look upward for our help. That's the way God designed it. In fact, a lot of times when we come close to experiencing burnout in our jobs, and we've all been there in different jobs, I'm sure, especially those of you that have been in areas, in positions of responsibility for a long time. You know, I think very often it comes, we have that struggle because we struggle in two areas. We struggle to accept the limitations that God has designed for us, and then we struggle to look to Christ for our strength and deliverance. So that's why I believe gospel-inspired leaders lead with this kind of ethic that we see in 1 Peter 4:11. It says, if anyone serves, and remember, leading is a form of service. So if anyone serves, he should do it with the strength God provides so that in all things God may be praised through Jesus Christ. If you succeed, but you did it just by the brute force of your own strength, you've learned nothing in the process, and you do not glorify God. But if you, even if you struggle through a tough project or a business that may not be as successful as you'd like it to be, but you're dependent on God, I know this, your work will not end in futility. You will glorify God through that process. Now, I want to wrap. I really want to start to wrap things up by telling you something that was quite pivotal in my career. I want to tell you a little story about when I was really just a. It was about 20 years ago. I was a first-time manager. I'd just taken over a group, I was managing a small software development group. And shortly after I took over, we had our first major software release. And to my dismay, it was a very serious bug. In fact, it was so serious that we had to reship that software. Eventually, we had to reship that software to 20,000 customers. Now, that's before the days of the internet download, so we were actually had to ship out these 3.5-inch discs. It cost money. I was the software that I was responsible for was tax accounting software. And so corporate accountants use it to close books, and it needed to calculate depreciation and assets. And any of you accountants in the accounting field? Okay. Well, we had a lot of angry customers. And I've seen angry accountants, you guys are not a nice bunch when you're not happy. Now, in the middle of all of that, I'm working really hard to fix this bug, test it with my team. We worked a lot of long hours, you know. Those of you that are, you know, accountants in finance arena, you know, tax accounting, there's a time sensitivity to this. You got to get it right in a particular window, right? So we're working really hard. And in the middle of that, the CEO of the company comes to my office. Now, I see him maybe once every 2 months or whatever. He comes to my office, so I thought, oh, well, see what he has to say. He plops himself on the chair in my office, and I start telling him, you know, Jim, I'm really sorry. I take full responsibility. It's under my watch. We're working hard. I explained to him all the things we were doing and why. And then I said to him, look, you know, when this is done, I'd like to go back to being a software developer, a software programmer. I'm not cut out for this management thing. It's too difficult. I messed up. I just, you know, if you, you know, I'll get us through this, but I want to go back to being a software developer. So, you know, he listened and then he said, if that's what you really want, that's fine. After this is done, we'll move you back. And no loss in pay. He was very gracious. But he says, I think that's a mistake. I think you have the seeds of a really good manager. And he said, if you retreat every time you make a mistake, you'll never do anything great or meaningful. So I believe in you, and I want you to succeed, and I'm doubling down on you. And then he said, hey, look, I make mistakes all the time. You know, he was very humble, and he just, and I thought that he was coming to my office to reprimand me, or at the very least to find out what I was doing to fix this problem as soon as possible. But he came with really just one goal. He wanted to encourage me. And if not for that encouragement at that time, I really don't think that I would have continued down the management path, which I actually believe was what I've been equipped to do, and the way God has gifted me. That was the right path. But God used this man to sort of intervene at the right time and to encourage me. Now, I don't know that he was a Christian, but I share this story to help you see the impact of really good business leadership, the impact it makes to a young manager who made a mistake. This act of kindness and encouragement made a huge difference to my professional life and to my career. He gave me a gift, really. And I have a desire for all of us. I have a desire that we'll make a difference to the people we lead and manage, not just for their present professional lives, but also for eternity. You know, as I was preparing for this talk, I came across this quote by C.S. Lewis, and I'm sure some of you have seen this before, but let me read it to you. "There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals with whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendors." I want you to think about that. We work with people that have an eternal destiny. You know, I know you take your job seriously. I certainly do. You know, I love my job. But even more important than the work we do, are the institutions we serve, are the projects we lead, are the people we work with. We never want to lose sight of that, we never want to lose sight of the opportunity God has given us to engage and influence them, not only for the present, but possibly for eternity as well. And the way we manage and lead them will tell them a lot about the God we serve.